Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to the Football Writers Podcast. It's another lockdown special featuring me, Mike Calvin, Adrian Clark, the tactical analyst, and Seb Stafford-Bloor from Football 365. There's something uniquely affecting about the death of a famous athlete. They're immortalised by their achievements, frozen in time, at their prime. Football has paid its respects to Norman Hunter and Peter Bonetti. Legends at smaller clubs like Alf Wood have also passed away. It got me thinking about heroes in a football context. What do they say about us and the game that produced them? You'll go first, Aid. Who was your first hero?
It's a good question, actually, because I was spotted by Arsenal fairly young. From the age of 10, 11 onwards, I was quite clinical about my sort of perception of football in terms of wanting to make it and whatnot. And I don't think I enjoyed the kind of fandom that a lot of people would have. So I would have to rewind to when I was really, really young. And I think that your heroes, the people that you fall in love with initially, are the ones you see in the flesh first. And I went to Ipswich Town, I went to Portman Road when it was the glory years under Bobby Robson, later to become Sir Bobby, of course. And Ipswich had never had a team like it. They won, well, they were runners up twice in a row in the old First Division. They won the UEFA Cup. My heroes were the entire team. I can still rattle off that team. Yeah, just like that. I mean, younger listeners wouldn't remember, but you got Cooper, Burley, Butcher, Osman, Mills, Tyson, Muren, Gates. You've got so many. Brazil. And the midfielder that was a Mariner, of course, up front. The one player I've missed out was my favourite player. So my hero, really, when I was 6, 7, 8, John Walk. John Walk was a grizzly Scot, but he had an unbelievable few years at Ipswich. I was looking at 80-81, which was the season, really, when I first got into football. 36 goals in 64 matches for John Walk that season. He was a midfielder. Quite remarkable, really, campaign. So he was my favourite in a team of heroes for everyone that lived in Suffolk at the time, Ipswich Town with the team. Yeah, so John Walk is the one that I looked to first.
Yeah, thanks for making me feel old, Aid. I actually covered that team in the UEFA Cup. I can remember it was in that cup run in the UEFA Cup, we ended up in Poland in a place called Łódź, and it was minus 17. Oh. And Kevin Beattie, who was one of the great players who didn't quite fulfil himself, played in that game in a short-sleeved shirt. I could not believe it because we were in the stands dressed like the Red Army. You know those hats that you have where they cover up your ears? Well, we were there and huddled, and he was just strutting about, and I just thought, wow, this guy is a superhuman. I suppose, you know, from my point of view, as a kid, as a ball boy at Watford, there were two players that probably people have never heard of. One was called Barry Endine, who was a sort of a bullocking striker, got the goal against Liverpool in the FA Cup quarter-final. And the other one's a Scottish winger called Stuart Scullion, who was a third division player simply because he never got his head up. He was brilliantly, brilliantly talented. You know, he could change pace. The ball was attached to his feet. He absolutely made life hell for fullbacks. But his crosses, it was just like a lottery. You know, they ended up anywhere. And occasionally they found their target. But if he could have had the capacity to just think a bit more, do it less instinctively, he would have been an absolute star. Yeah. But there we are. Mm. What about you, Seb?
I cheated, guys. I've actually got two, because what Adrian said about players you see for the first time in the flesh really resonates with me. So I think the player I pretended to be in the playground was probably Paul Gascoigne. Just because, firstly, I was a little bit of a fat child. and Gascoigne didn't look like an athlete. Even then, like now the sort of the definition of a football player has changed physically. But then Gascoigne made the game look fun. Like, obviously, you know, his talent spoke for itself, and we know what he was as a footballer. But I think he made the game look enjoyable. And there was something about the way he played that appealed to me when I was probably about 7 or 8 years old. I grew up in Oxford, and while Gascoigne was kind of a TV figure for me, I spent sort of my early years watching Oxford United at the Manor Ground. I was a bit of a death trap of a football stadium that actually, it was just, you know, I mean, looking back at pictures now, I can't believe they let people in there. It was just, yeah.
I loved it. Yeah, great.
With a big slope towards London Road end.
Yeah.
You had to go up. But I suppose a lot of people won't have heard of him, but Joey Beacham back then was just a mesmerising footballer. I mean, he's known now today because of that aborted transfer to West Ham and him lasting a couple of months before being bombed out back to the Thames Valley in Swindon Town. But watching Beacham then, it was like nothing he couldn't do with the ball. He used to glide past defenders. He's one of the most one-footed players I've ever seen, actually. But he had such an elegance about him. Yeah, he was at Oxford at the time, they were sort of paralysed by the post-Robert Maxwell days, and they were stymied by, you know, financial hardship, and ultimately why Beacham had to go to West Ham. But that was kind of within the context of that side where, you know, every couple of weeks, every couple of months, there'd be a new loan signing, there'd be a new player that nobody had ever heard of. Beacham, because of his attachment to the area, was a constant. And Beacham was someone who never really wanted to leave, and who was a sort of made the side competitive almost against anybody. Actually, I spoke to him a few years ago. He had a bit of a difficult time after he retired. Glad to say that his life has kind of rebounded and things are looking up for him. But he's just a normal guy. He was a supremely gifted player. I really believe, even now, that he probably had his career gone a different way. He probably could have played for England. I mean, he was left-footed and a left-winger, so it wasn't as if England had a surplus of those. Mm. But he, yeah, there was a normality to him, but also just a wonderfully gifted player and entertaining.
Played against him. Yeah.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Did you really?
Yeah. How was that? During that era. Yeah. No, I remember him as being fantastic. Yeah. No, really, really, really talented. And by the way, the player a little bit later that I really looked up to, I couldn't really shout about it because he represented Spurs at the time. was Chris Waddle. Chris Waddle was the player that I really looked up to. And we had some good role models at Arsenal. David Rowcastle used to watch week in, week out. Used to, you know, just love watching him. Limpar the same. But Chris Waddle was always my favourite. But yeah, when he played at White Hart Lane, I had to keep that one on the lowdown.
I've always thought it's the players that are expressive. Like, as you get older, you start to appreciate the functionality of footballers and the roles that they do. When you're a boy, or when you're first learning how to play the game, whether it's a professional or like me as an amateur or something, you know, I think it's the players that sort of are uninhibited that really attract you. Those are the ones that always stick in my mind, definitely.
Yeah, well, I suppose what this is doing is you know, emphasising the power of nostalgia, especially in these current times. I threw this out yesterday to the listeners to give me some of their own examples. You know, we've got a low back and probably enough for a couple of programmes, but they basically span the generations, which is, you know, quite good for us in many ways. So we can really look at it in the round, as it were. I'll start with Mark Osborne. He says, look, can I put forward Stan Bowles? I went to QPR with Dad for the first time in 1973. And from then on, I only wanted to see Stan. He was captivating. And the 75-76 season was the best football I've seen. He played as if he didn't care either way. And I fell in love. Which is lovely and poetic. And I suppose it also points out the attraction of the maverick footballer, and Stan was, you know, a maverick footballer. It's the old story, wasn't it? You know, if he could pass a betting shop in the way that he passed the ball, he'd be okay, but he wasn't. What do you think about that whole idea of the maverick player, Seb?
I love it, Mike. I'm still seduced by it now. I think someone like Bowles he's in a category of someone like Rodney Marsh or Frank Worthington, that kind of footballer. thought for a long time why this is, why, you know, because often those are the players that, you know, well, they entertain people, they don't quite achieve what they should have done or what their talent should have allowed them to. And I think it's because they live their lives in quite an ordinary way. They're fallible in the way that a lot of people are. So, you know, betting and drinking, you know, and socializing, these are very human afflictions. And I think there'll always be something really attractive about someone who lives like an ordinary person, but has a supernatural ability on a Saturday afternoon. I think it's that. I don't know exactly what it is, but that's a common theme with all of those players that fit into that category. You could even go back to someone like sort of Len Shackleton, not in the kind of the social sense, but in the way that he wasn't bound by the constraints of the game. He wanted to entertain people. He thought of the people in the stands. And I think that's a really valuable commodity.
Yeah. I think the other one, most common type of hero is the tough guy, isn't it? The cruncher of tackles, the one that the leader of men, the one that puts in that reducer every now and again and wipes somebody out. I think a lot of players, it depends, I think, sometimes on what you're like as a person, what position you play on in the pitch. But someone like Tony Adams, for example, you know, not a maverick footballer by any sense of example, but he'd be a hero to the hundreds of thousands of Arsenal fans for the way that he played, which was sort of leading by example, I guess.
Yeah, I'd throw Barry Kitchener there from Millwall. He was on a permanent diet of reducers, I think. The other type of player is someone who gets the most out of himself. You know, people talk about Gary Neville in that context. Tony Mee puts forward Kevin Keegan as someone who overcame that too small tag to become one of the best of his era. And he tells us he came from Doncaster, which gives you a clue as to which club at which he coaches. Kevin Keegan absolutely make the most of himself, didn't he, Aide?
He did, yeah. He was a fantastic footballer, just so busy, so energetic, just enthusiastic, wasn't he? And I think when you go and watch football and you go and pay your money, your own money, or your mum and dad's money to go and watch a team, then you want to see real energy and enthusiasm. I think and 100% effort, and Keegan always did that. I mean, what a career he had, and I love the fact that he was one of the first to really be a pioneer and go and play overseas in German football, where he scaled even greater heights, unbelievably. And you know, he was at one point, was he European Footballer of the Year, Kevin Keegan?
Yep.
I think he might have been. Yeah. So, I think ability-wise, good ability, but not exceptional. But he got there because of that hard work and enthusiasm. And that those qualities are incredibly endearing, aren't they, to fans of sport in general?
Yeah. Let's look at another club. Gina Huff, who's a Man United supporter, she said, look, it would have been Scholesy for his unswerving loyalty until I saw a documentary a few years ago on Cyril Regis. If we're talking about heroes, Cyril all day long. Do you get that one, Seb?
Absolutely. I mean, I can understand the resonance of Cyril Regis. I mean, I was going to jump in on something that Adrian said, like with the players that, because we're talking about Man United, the players that sort of extract the most from themselves, I throw someone like Gary Neville into that mix as well.
Yeah.
Like, I know what I know some of parts of his personality rub people the wrong way, but I find him a very sincere pundit on the game, very, very entertaining commentator. But you look at someone that wasn't necessarily born with extravagant gifts. I think Cyril Regis was a very gifted player. I look at Neville as more of a functional person, someone that absolutely, almost through an iron will, developed a career in the game, and what a career that was as well. And I think sort of if you read his autobiography, or you know sort of listen to the anecdotes about how Peter Schmeichel used to mock him for his bad crossing and how he used to spend his time trying to refine his technique as a result of that, I think kind of that's the essence of footballer that you don't really find today, because I don't think there's necessarily the opportunity for a Neville, or perhaps a better example is Frank Lampard. There isn't the opportunity for someone like that to survive the cuts at academy level and then develop and learn and hone their craft. But it's really interesting, actually, how many people say, when they're asked about heroes, how many people opt for someone that they can relate to, in the kind of sense that of someone that perhaps struggled for a career and overcame sort of maybe physical or technical limitations.
I think if you look at Cyril, though, you know, he had a symbolic career and life. Mm. you know, the 3 degrees at West Brom, in an era in which racism was overt and consistent. So in that sense, you know, we talk quite loosely about football producing role models, Aid, but he was a true role model, you know, heck of a player, but also as a as an individual, he made a big impact on people.
What he had to take, what he had to put up with in terms of racism during the peak of his career was, you just wouldn't wish it on your worst enemy. And he did it, he handled it, did it with a smile on his face, and inspired people through his brilliance on the pitch, as well as rising above what was going on around him to be the better person. And that's why he's seen as such a hero by so many people. I think when he passed away, it was it hit home when you read about his career and his life. It just reminded you of what he'd been through. So no, I think he's a genuine hero, Cyril Regis, not just for what he did, you know, particularly for West Brom at the Hawthorns, but for how he carried himself in the face of just such spiteful racism at the time. I just thought was brilliant.
Do you guys find it strange that players like Albert Johannesson and Clyde Best aren't featured more in this kind of conversation? I read Clyde Best's autobiography about 6 months ago, and some of the things he describes in there made me wince. Are we, unfortunately, you know, racially aggravated anecdotes are a common part of football still, which is ridiculous, but that is the case. So we're all a little bit hardened to it. But some of the things he describes are just absolutely horrifying. And when you think that Johannesson was playing in not quite the era before, but the decade before, and you think that sort of the things that sort of they had to tolerate to make a career for themselves, obviously in Johannesson's case, it had a very detrimental effect on the rest of his life. But it's interesting that those people are more of a part of the conversation. Cyril Regis, absolutely, quite rightly so. Laurie Cunningham, you know, absolutely. John Barnes. These are pioneers, trailblazers in different kinds of ways. But the things that had to be tolerated and the strength of personality that some of these founding fathers, some of these formative players, I can't even relate to it. It's just absolutely dreadful.
Yeah, well said. You know, as I said, we had an awful lot of response to this. I'll pick one more and then we'll come back to this on Thursday if we could, guys. Paul McAwenny, he puts forward two guy at Blackburn. He said, look, I've rarely seen anyone so unhurried when receiving the ball other than maybe the world's top 10. He was a hero in the way he quietly stepped up at Premier League level and did it. Souness stated he was the most talked about player by opposition managers in his career. And I suppose, Aid, that's the accolade, isn't it? If your opponent talks about you, you're making an impact.
Yeah, 100%, yeah. Yeah, no, I wish more of my opponents talked about me.
Oh, they did, but they had a bit of a giggle, didn't they?
Yeah, I was just saying, who? I didn't know he was playing. Tuchel was class. And I think it was the fact that he Blackburn as well, wasn't it? You know, he wasn't the most fashionable of places or teams, but yeah, he was just a great footballer to watch. And yeah, if you're watching these kind of players week in, week out, it's very, very easy to fall in love with them.
Yep. In terms of that Blackburn team, it tends to get overlooked, you know, the Premier League winning team. What's your assessment of that team, Seb?
Interesting, because I think over time, the way it was built has kind of been overlooked. Obviously, Jack Walker was behind it, and Blackburn spent an awful lot of money assembling that side. So you can look at it two different ways. You can see them as a kind of the romantic fairy tale that pit Manchester United to the, you know, to the post, or you can see them as a kind of precursor for what football would become. So maybe, you know, I know it involves a little bit of license, and the finances in the 90s were very, very different to what exists today. But you look at the sums spent on Alan Shearer, Tim Flowers, players like that, Jason Wilcox, Stuart Ripley, it's the prototype for Chelsea, Manchester City. It's a prototype for the quick build, essentially, isn't it? I remember getting behind Blackburn because, let's be honest, in the 90s, Manchester United had run over most of our teams a couple of times. And even by that point, they'd provoked a little bit of resentment and jealousy. But it just makes me think of that final day, that final Jamie Redknapp free kick. And it's one of the strangest things I've ever seen, the sort of the reaction at Anfield to a Liverpool player scoring a terrific goal, but possibly handing the title at the time, they thought, to Manchester United. It's one of the, I mean, I honestly, I think it's a kind of, it's a better story than the Manchester City QPR year, which, you know, I mean, it's dramatic in a lot of ways, of course, but I think the sort of the nature of that was a little bit more compelling.
On Tugo, very quickly, another reason why I think Rovers fans worship him so much is that he came to them in the twilight of his career. He was 30, 31, I think, and gave them, you know, I think 7 or 8 great seasons. Not as a modern athlete, not as someone who's charging around the pitch, you know, particularly, but just someone who was just class in possession. So, yeah, great player.
I think Sir Alex Ferguson tried to sign him when he was about 33. He was that good.
Yeah.
That he
that doesn't happen, 32, does it? 30,
it doesn't happen now, but, yeah. But Ferguson had a bit of previous with that. He tried to do it with Di Canio as well and to you guys. So that's a pretty special category of player. And Henrik Larsson perhaps is in that in that little bracket. So it's a pretty special category of player to be in.
Yeah. Let's sort of change tack if we could, guys, just to talk a little bit. I know we've dwelt on this subject almost ad nauseam over the last few weeks about when and if the season's going to get going again. It looks now that the talk is of a June the 8th restart. Now, as a target, is that meaningless because no one really knows what's going to go on? Or do we think that actually we will get to the stage where there will be a hard and fast decision to resume the season behind closed doors and get some certainty to the process, however inappropriate or not that might seem to the wider world?
I think it still feels early, but to me, look, just with the seriousness of the situation around us, it still feels quite soon to be starting. But I do get the feeling there's a real determination for football to be one of the first things to come back, albeit not in its usual guise, being behind closed doors, etc. So a lot of things have got to improve between now and then in the wider picture. As long as hospitals aren't overrun in the way they are now, and that the players and staff and all the people that are going to have to be part of this match day are going to be safe and that they're not ill at the time, then yeah, let's look towards that. And it's good to have a target. Personally, I don't care if it's June the 8th, July the 8th, August the 8th, September the 8th. Really, I just think we'll be ready when we're ready. But yeah, I get the growing sense that June is a very, that everyone involved in football is determined to get it back in June, not least because of the money that is being spent on nothing really in terms of wages right now.
Yeah. Brighton's Paul Barber, I think's come across as a very measured voice in this whole debate. You know, he's talked about trying to ease the soullessness of a behind closed doors game. He's talking about piping in music. Does that just become too artificial, do you think, Seb?
Yeah, so you know that scene in Apocalypse Now when they're having barbecues on the beach and they're singing songs and they're playing the acoustic guitar and Willard says something like, you know, the more they try to make it like home, the more everyone just missed it. I think it's that. I think the more, and I think we're already experiencing that because, you know, there's an awful lot of nostalgia out there and we do a lot of it and I love it. But the more we talk about it, the more I miss the sport. And I think the problem is if you go down the road of piping in crowd noise and, you know, goal celebrations and chants, I think you almost make it worse. I think you have to in that situation. And I have no real reference to this, but I think you have to almost embrace the oddity of the scenario, where you say it's an empty stadium game, it is what it is, let's not go down the route of, you know, hologram crowd members and, you know, soundtracks and, I don't know, like whatever else is in that sort of...
I don't hate the idea of it. I don't.
Oh, Adrian.
I don't
oh,
hate Adrian. The idea. I don't. Maybe I'm on my own. I don't know.
Might it's kick just, him off the pod for that.
I just think it's like watching a training session. That's the problem. I love football. You know, I'm obsessed by football. Always have been. I've watched hundreds of games. I've played in hundreds of games where there have been no crowd. But I find it hard. I don't enjoy it as much. But we're going to have to accept it. But yeah, I didn't think it was the worst idea in the world. I think on night games, I don't know if there's a way of turning the lights off in the stands. So basically, the lights are on the pitch. We can black out everything. Just seeing so many empty seats it does make it feel soulless. And it's the thud of the ball. It's hearing the players talking to each other. I don't know if that's what people really want.
Adrian, did you ever play at Highbury? You know when they were rebuilding? I think it was the clock end they were rebuilding.
The mural, the North Bank.
Yeah, with so for younger people who haven't seen it, just Google it. That's a kind of a controversy of its own, of course, but for different reasons. But was that not weird to be playing in front of, you know, sort of a cartoon? Like a cartoon crowd.
Yeah, I played many, many, I think, youth games and reserve games at Highbury there when the mural was there. Yeah, it was right close, right up behind the goal.
You
could clear it. I mean, you'd have to really sky your shot to clear it. But yeah, it was basically a picture of a Sabutio stand full of fans. and rumour had it that they did sort of pipe out some kind of noise from that end. I don't know how they did that, but I don't know if that's factually correct or not, but no, it was better to do that than to play in front of a building site, in my opinion, even though people laughed at it incessantly.
I'll open this can of worms very briefly and then shut it quickly. But I'm convinced that some clubs do actually pipe some crowd noise in just to get things going. So I suppose it's not authentic. Let's put it like that.
No, players would know it's not authentic, Mike. But I think having a background noise might make it feel more normal. But look, it feels like I'm in the minority here.
Yeah. Well, I suppose football is a communal experience, isn't it? And I suppose, you know, our next area of discussion, the great tournaments that we've experienced and enjoyed, probably bears that out. Italia 90 was a national obsession, which then became a national trauma. And it was quite weird. I covered the whole lot right from the time that England were preparing in Sardinia at the Forte, which was basically a posh Butlins. It was a strange tournament. It wasn't a brilliant tournament if you look at the stats. It was only an average of 2.2 goals per game, which is a record low. There were a record, I think, at the time, anyway, 16 red cards in that tournament. England's initial group was tedium personified. It was just awful. The Netherlands, England, Republic of Ireland, Egypt. In those six games, no team managed to score more than once, and England beat Egypt 1-0. That was the only game with a decisive result. So it was a strange time. Just, you know, I'll come back with some of my other memories, which are specifically on Bobby Robson, who was taking an awful lot of stick at the time, the whole Gaza incident. What are your memories? So probably it's closer to you in terms of, was this the first World Cup you really got into?
Yeah, it would have been. So basically, this was the summer when my mum spilt a cup of tea on one of those old school TVs and it broke. And so without any internet, without any streaming devices, that was not the best World Cup summer for me after that point. So I think we got as far the last memory I have of it is the Cameroon game, and then then bless my mum,
oh,
she knocked over a cup of tea.
That's unbelievable.
But isn't this obviously, if you look, it was quite interesting because the BBC showed the Germany semi-final a couple of days ago, and a lot of people that, you know, had never seen it before as live got to watch it. It's really interesting to see that style of football, and you can see exactly why the back pass rule wasn't far off. It's amazing that it lasted as long as it did, because obviously it wasn't the only reason for the negativity of that tournament, but it's one of them. And you see sort of centre-halves kicking it back into a goalkeeper's hand. It's such a strange, as strange as it was when they outlawed it, and goalkeepers were no longer allowed to use their hands in back passes, it's actually stranger to watch it now, over like 20 years later, given the sort of the aesthetic we've become so used to. And I suppose that's a really important legacy, because that's sort of birthed what the game is today. If you think about how Guardiola uses goalkeepers, how he mandates how the ball is worked out from the back, it all really comes from something which came to pass, the Italian 90.
Yeah, I suppose for me that tournament really took off over the course of 2 days. I went to see the Republic of Ireland and Romania in, it was Genoa, Sampdoria Stadium there. And you know, the Irish won 5-4 on pens. They didn't miss. David O'Leary stepped up to score the decisive penalty. And then the following day in Bologna, that was when the World Cup really took off for England, I think, when David Platt scored that fantastic goal last minute of extra time against Belgium. Again, we've talked about this in the past. You know, that was where we were gabbling, ad-libbing down the phone against all sorts of deadlines. You know, a huge adrenaline rush of a game. That Platt goal has gone down in history, hasn't it, Aid?
Yeah, it has. Yeah, that's one of the moments I would 100% pick out from that tournament. It was one of those out of your seat, jump around the living room, go absolutely crazy moments, because we were staring at another penalty shootout. We weren't very good at those and came up with a worldie. No, that was the moment that I think fans around the country began to really get behind Bobby Robson's team. For me, the tournament, even though there was a lot of really dull games, it was the first one where the media and the TV really dressed it up, and it became a bigger event because of the coverage. Nessun Dorma, I'm talking about. It was that when I think of Italia 90, I think Pavarotti, I think the theme tune, and then I think about some of the bigger moments that because there were some great moments. Roger Miller, I mean, what a story he was. Got the winner, didn't he, against Argentina on the opening day. Scalacci came from nowhere to be the home nation's hero. He was sensational. I love the Italian kit. They were glamorous with Baggio and Donadoni. Glorious. But yeah, I suppose we look at it from England's point of view. Crazy game against Cameroon in the quarters. Just about scraped it, thanks to Gary Lineker. And then we know what happened against Germany. But you're right about the back pass rule. From that moment onwards, it was pretty much outlawed, wasn't it? So yeah, for me it was a special tournament because it made football even more mainstream than it had ever been before. I think more families got into it, because in the 80s and the 70s, football hooliganism had been associated with football, and it was a bit ugly at times. It became more of a, we had superstars, didn't we? We had Gazza, we had Gary Lineker on our screen, we had Gazza crying. I think that moment, in a way, almost touched the hearts of the nation, and football became bigger than it had been previous to that. And lo and behold, well, you know, a couple of years later, the Premier League was born, and we never looked back.
You know what's interesting is that I was, when we were researching for this, like, I went back, I found obviously some footage from Italian 90 itself, but I found an old episode, a reaction episode of Saint and Greavesy from after the Argentina-Cameroon game. And that's just brilliant TV, because we haven't quite reached the point in the game's history where everything is super serious yet. Like, yeah. Jimmy Greaves is still able. He's got this little voodoo doll of a referee that he pulls apart during the episode. And so it's right in the sweet spot of the game mattering an awful lot more to, let's say, a different type of person. In time, because it's emerging from the 70s and 80s, but you've also, it's still fun, you know, TV coverage is still allowed to be slightly offbeat, not in a sort of banter way, but in a, you know, it's football and we love it, but we're allowed to have a little bit of a joke at its expense sometimes. If anyone's never seen that, Saint and Greavesy is one of the fondest memories of my childhood, just because of what they were on ITVs on a Sunday afternoon. Yeah, but go and dig that out if you're under 25.
I've got a recording of myself being on Saint and Greavesy from
really?
Back in the day. Yeah, which is awesome. And it links in nicely because it was at the trials to get into the FA National School at Lillishall. This would have been 1989. I would have been 14. And Saint and Greavesy did a feature on it. And they did it because guess who was running those trials of 14-year-olds looking for the best 16 in the country at the time? Bobby Robson. The national team manager was there with his clipboard on the sideline, G'ing everyone up, you know, basically controlling it. And yeah, it was just unbelievable to be a part of it. And then for me as a kid, to then a year later, watch him and the sort of nation hate him at first and then fall in love with him was really special, actually.
That's amazing, Abe, because I didn't know that, actually. Mm-hmm. But You've got it in one there with the way that the mood changed. And I think people tend to forget how poisonous the atmosphere was going into that tournament. You know, we had Bobby committing himself to go to PSV. Headlines, traitor, plonker, we're a laughing stock. Badges, Robson must go. It was almost rescued by the absurdity of Gazza. in a way, because, you know, we used to go to the holiday camp to see them. And Gaz would always be getting up to something. And there's a famous clip of him getting a full chocolate cake in the face from Chris Waddle, which was pretty much standard behaviour. And, you know, as Bobby used to say, he said, look, you know, basically, when you play a game, we should have two balls, one for Gazza and give another one to the rest. And I thought it was a really poignant relationship between Gazza and Bobby, because it was paternal, but it was also, it was so touching that I suppose Gazza, you know, I remember Gazza saying, and I think he's probably talked about this subsequently, about almost how he felt safe on a football pitch and in a football environment, because that was what he knew. And the whole world of, in inverted commas, celebrity to which he was subjected was so unreal, he didn't really know how to deal with it. As a footballer, and again, you know, I'm conscious that, you know, quite a few people probably are listening to that, this really have never seen Gascoigne at his height. What was his impact on the game, do you think, Seb, at that particular moment?
Oh, goodness, what a big question. I think his... let me refine it. I think his impact on British football, because I don't think we've had many players who play like he did. We can argue about when it was that his career reached its apex. I'd argue the cup final and the tackle on Gary Charles, even if he had some very fine years at Rangers. Even now, if you look back at what he could do with a football in relation to what the typical English player did with it, I think Gascoigne, in a really pretentious way, I think he restored a bit of ego. I think one of the games that should be sort of most fondly remembered from his career is the game with the Dutch at Italian 90, because rather than 96, because he did all the things that Dutch footballers were associated with. To see an English player play like that for a new generation of people, for people who are my age, is incredibly powerful, but probably in a way that we don't realise, Mike, because to talk of Gascoigne now, unfortunately, like, if there's no way of getting around it, there's an awful lot of other things that we have to involve in that conversation. It's just not about football anymore. It's a cautionary tale. It's about society. But as a footballer, enormously powerful figure.
Yeah. I don't think we'd seen players play for England for a number of years prior to that play with the same liberation as
maybe Gazza. Glenn Hoddle. Maybe, yeah. Glenn Hoddle.
Well, even then, I think he was a little bit restricted. Yeah. At times, I think he just was himself, and he was the line breaker, wasn't he? The ultimate line breaker. Yeah. In central midfield, you're not supposed to be able to take players on and break the lines and spark attacks, but that's what he did for fun. And we were used to seeing foreigners do that. That was what the greats of Dutch football, Spanish football, Italian, German, that's what they did. And then suddenly we had one. I'd have to be honest, I mean, very few footballers have been produced since in the same mould. I think they really only made one mould for Gazza, didn't they?
Yeah, and you know, he will be remembered for the tears when he realised that if England got to the final, he wouldn't be playing. You know, it was such a dramatic evening but for most of it, I was convinced England were going to win. Even when Paul Parker deflected that shot in the early going, Gary Lineker's equaliser wasn't a surprise. Then we come down to penalties, and I suppose the whole neurosis of penalties engulfed us. I can remember Bobby being almost, well, he was so crestfallen afterwards. It was interesting, I'd seen him at Mexico, and he was incandescent with Maradona's cheating. Here he was almost battered down by fate, and he was really, he cut a really quite sad figure. Now, I understand that. So my impression of it on the day was, obviously, it's a professional thing. So, you know, again, we were under deadline pressure. I think from memory, I think the game ended just after 11:30 at night. And I know it was still about 25 degrees at the time. But there was a personal thing as well, because there was something about Bobby that made you love him. You know, there was that boyishness about him. He could hand out some stick, but he was a very fair man and a very good man. Just very briefly, give me both your impressions of that penalty shootout. Where were you and how did you react?
Well, Seb never saw it, did he?
TV hadn't been fixed by then, no.
Radio, I suppose, yeah. I would have been in the
radio room. In the background.
Yeah, I would have been in the living room with my mum and dad and my brother Alex, and we'd have been all on the edge of our seats. And yeah, I don't know. I don't know what I'd have done. I'd probably lobbed a cushion or something. I'd have been quite angry about it at the time. But yeah, it was just devastating because that momentum had built up that we all believed at that time that Gazza and Lineker and Sir Bobby would drive us all the way. Yeah, it was the dreaded penalties, wasn't it?
That was the first time I can remember being hurt by football.
Yeah, it did hurt. Yeah, it was.
It's a feeling like you know, when you're a teenager and you know the first time you get dumped, it's like that feeling. It's a kind of it's an actual wound.
Got used to it. Got used to it.
See, people listening don't know that we've got Skype on, and I can see you both smirking before you said that.
Oh dear.
Okay, let's. Yeah, this is a real gear shift. Let's go into management, shall we? I want to just talk about three managers today in this series that we're doing: David Moyes, Nuno, and Nigel Pearson. Start with David Moyes. I don't think he gets the respect, perhaps, that he deserves. You know, when you think of what he did at Everton, building an entire club, Manchester United tainted him, let's be honest. But I think what he did at West Ham should have got greater praise, and he seems to be doing the same thing again. Abe, what do you think about David Moyes?
I get exactly where you're coming from. Personally, I'm not a fan, and it's not because I don't think he's a good manager. He clearly has been a very, very good manager. At Everton, he was sensational. No other word to describe it. But I think that what happened at United affected his confidence, and I just don't see that light in his eyes anymore, that spark. And I don't think he gets the players to play with that fire and that belief and that energy that he had at Everton. I don't think he's been able to replicate that since. And that's just the way I look at it. I know that's quite critical of a very good footballing man, but I just think he lost something through that Manchester United experience. And for me, it's just a bit too defensive, a bit too dour now. And yeah, his teams before were vibrant and hungry and unbelievably aggressive. And I don't know if they are anymore.
Would you concur, Seb?
Yeah, just about. I also think he doesn't help himself. I mean, when he was unveiled by West Ham, this press conference, he said something along the lines of, yeah, no, winning is what I do. After saying, yeah, I've seen your win percentage in the Premier League. Like, you know, he kind of, his media handling isn't the best, and maybe that shouldn't be a decisive factor, but it does change the way you look at him. I mean, what I will say is his first, we don't know what his second spell at West Ham is going to be yet, let's be fair. His first, I think if we look back, knowing what we do now, he did pretty well with an ownership who don't always make life easy. You've got their own ideas, who probably believe a little bit too strongly in their own football acumen. So I think he's warranted some respect for that. I don't know, Mike, Everton's such a long time ago now. I mean, it doesn't seem like it, time passes quickly in football, but it's almost a different era of the game. And it's kind of, harking back to that is like referencing Sam Allardyce's Bolton. Seems it's relevant without being sort of particularly pertinent at the moment, if that makes sense.
Okay, I suspect you're going to be a little bit more generous towards the next one, Seb. Nuno, you like him, don't you?
Love him. I think he's tactically one of the finest managers in the division. Anytime you know, it's like a Molyneux. You have those, you know, the press box is high up and you're almost on top of the pitch. And it's, you know, it's definitely the best, one of the best vantage points in the league. You see how clever and well connected his team is. And also, because of Wolves' wealth and their relationship with George Mendes, it was always assumed, right, well, they're just going to stack this team full of individuals and they're going to be a kind of a by-the-numbers sort of success. Now, I would argue that he's done amazing things with players that, not that people hadn't heard of, but that nobody would have promoted into that situation. Like Raul Jimenez, people talk of now as someone that could play for just about any team within the top six. Wolves are, you know, in the top six themselves, but the notional top six. And you think, okay, but you know, 2 years ago, Raul Jimenez was just someone that wasn't thought of as capable enough to cut it in Europe. He'd had barren times at Atletico Madrid. He was never prolific in Benfica. He hadn't actually scored. He hadn't actually reached double figures, I don't think, since he left Mexican football. And you see what he is now. You see also what Nuno's been able to do with a Rubik's Cube like Adama Traore, who no other manager's really been able to work out to this extent. Diogo Jota, the sort of, I know Ruben Neves is a hugely talented player, but his career has come on dramatically. Thiago Martinho, he's got a final tune out of. Willy Boley, Matt Doherty, Connor Cody. I mean, all these players, it's just an endless list, Mike. You know, Pedro Neto as well is in there. I think he's going to be a fantastic player.
Aid, do you think that, you know, we almost saw him at the start as Jorge Mendes's man, but he's actually more than that.
Oh, yeah, much more. Yeah, he's a very, very accomplished coach. The work on the training ground is outstanding. And as Seb has brilliantly outlined, he improves players. Great eye, clearly, for the types of players that will fit into his strategies and identity. I mean, he has the clearest identity, I think, along probably with Sheffield United, of anyone in the Premier League, Liverpool as well, you can put into that category. Just you know how Wolves will play. Now, my only criticism would be, and it's only a criticism because we don't know, is can he adapt? Can he change his style of football? Can he change his formations? I know he tweaks with three at the back at times. I'd like to see him just maybe mix it up a little bit more. I'd like to see him just shock opponents with a flat back four every now and again, maybe, just to get over the line in a match. And that, I think, would just tick another box for me that he really is one of the elite coaches. That's the only thing missing. Their football is a little bit by numbers, I think, but they're so good at it, they're so well drilled that it's effective for them. So yeah, one or two little things in the future that boxes to tick, but he's superb, no doubt.
Yeah, the final one for today anyway, Nigel Pearson, in the process of almost reinventing himself at Watford, again, we don't know how that's all going to pan out. It was an appointment which surprised quite a lot of people. Is he the new this generation Sam Allardyce? Well, we'll wait to find that one out. For someone who left Leicester in unfortunate circumstances, Seb, he's actually done well to actually rally himself round, hasn't he?
He definitely has. I mean, Nigel Pearson is a really, really excellent coach. I mean, that's been lost in translation, obviously, because of what happened next at Leicester, the circumstances surrounding his departure. What I will say, he's the only manager that actually unsettles me in press conferences. The last one I did with him was he was after Watford had lost at home to Everton, had lost a 2-0 lead and lost 3-2 in stoppage time. Someone a couple of rows ahead of me said, you know, Nigel, you know, that was a little bit naive. and he turns to the person and was like, well, naive how? And everyone else is sitting there thinking, well, in the sense that you've lost a 2-goal lead and been done on the counter-attack in stoppage time against a team who are playing with 10 men. But he's slightly, I think it hurts him. It makes him entertaining, but it makes him at times a little bit of a spitting image puppet, because he's a little bit confrontational and he's a little bit offbeat. And, you know, whilst a lot of managers will just, you know, volley their way through press conferences and then leave as quickly as possible, it's like he's the protagonist. And sometimes I think that because of the way we report on football and because of how enraptured we are by, you know, character-based storylines, I think that disguises what a capable football mind there is and what an effect he's had on Watford. I can't even remember what state they're in as when the game paused, but the improvement on what they were was dramatic. And he deserves an awful lot of credit for that, because that was a football club full of players who didn't really want to be there and, you know, who'd lost all, you know, useful confidence by the time that Kike Sanchez Flores left.
Mm. Yeah, no, you're right about that. He challenges people. He's definitely confrontational.
It's really weird.
Well, obviously, you're worried that he's going to compare to some kind of animal,
you think,
I guess.
He's going to come jumping across the desk, Adrian, and rip your head off. But terrifying.
But that personality in a football environment can work, especially in a short-term sense where you're challenging players, you're confronting them about their opinions, their perception of how they're performing potentially, And I can imagine that he has quite a good effect on the footballers in terms of perking them up. And I think we saw that at Watford. Maybe they'd been a little bit too chilled out under the previous couple of managers, certainly under Kike Sanchez Flores. But yeah, no, I think he's an excellent organiser. No nonsense, clear instructions, but there are obvious limitations in terms of style of football. What I'll say with Watford, he went back to his sort of plan A, which is be solid, play on the counter-attack. Let's not be afraid to be direct. But cast your mind back to Leicester with the great escape season prior to Ranieri. He changed his system that season. He went away from what he'd always done. He went for three at the back. He went for something a little bit different, and it worked. And he got them over the line, and the rest is history at Leicester. So I think tactically he's underrated, but yeah, he's one from the old school, shall we say?
Certainly is. Now, you know, we're running out of time as per usual. Very quickly, boys. Scores on the doors. I would give David Moyes 7. Nuno 8 and Nigel Pearson 6. You guys?
Oh, I think you're generous with Moyes there, Mike. I'm going to drop him down to a 5 just because of the last couple of years. Nuno's a 9 for me and Pearson's an 8, I say.
Yeah, 6 for Moyes. So very solid 8 for Nuno with potential scope to be a 9 in the future. Pearson, I'm going to go a solid 7 for Nigel Pearson. I prefer him to Moyes. If I was a Watford or a West Ham, I'd rather be working with Pearson than Moyes, I have to be honest.
Okay. Well, just a final then, thought for the day. Again, as brief as you can, boys, what do you want to get off your chest? Hey, start with you.
Andy Pilley, the Fleetwood chairman. I spoke to him on the radio the other day. I love what he's doing with the videos. He's been very transparent. He's got ideas on how to survive, how EFL clubs can survive. But look, 10 to 12 clubs is his saying that could go to the wall here. And I just think that is, let's just pause and have a think about that. 10 to 12 EFL clubs, some big clubs, are in serious danger of going out of business. No crowds potentially until Christmas time. Income streams just gone. Yet they've got to find ways to pay the players. They might not pay them the full wages, but they've still got to pay. They've still got to employ these guys. You know, furloughing is obviously one option, but there are still other costs, other bills to pay. So that's just my thought. What can we do? Is there any way that the people that do have a lot of money, organisations that are flush with cash at the top of the game, or even the government, is there any way we can protect these clubs from going out of business? Because it really would be, there are tragedies everywhere you look at the moment, but it would be such a tragedy to lose 10 or 12 clubs by the time we come out of this.
Yeah, well said. Seb?
I read an interview with a guy you know very well, Mike, Marvin Sordell, over the weekend in the Daily Mirror. He was talking about the lack of support players have from the PFA when they find themselves with mental health difficulties, addictions, and other troubles within their lives. And he also speaks about how he approached them with potential solutions. I like Marvin. I think he's a really important voice for the future of professional football. I think he's someone that should be listened to more. In this instance, I think what he says should be tallied with perhaps how the PFA has held itself, what they've presented, and their sort of portrayal of themselves as kind of being of the collective interest. Not sure I really buy that. What Marvin says also tallies with some off-the-record conversations I've had with people in the past. He's someone to be paying a lot of attention to. Yep. At the moment.
Yeah, that ties in actually with my point, really. There have been a couple of stories recently looking at the mental health of young players released by clubs. Now, it's 4 years since I began researching the subject for my book on youth football, No Hunger in Paradise. If we're plugging, the BT Sport documentary of the same name still available. What strikes me is that clubs still don't seem to care about their duty of care. You've got terrific organisations working outside the system. I'm thinking of an organisation like PlayersNet, which basically provides confidential advice and support. An organisation like that doesn't get any official financial backing, which I think is a disgrace, frankly. It's wrong. And I think now more than ever, football needs to change its attitude. You can't sell a dream and then run away when that dream dies. So thanks to you for joining us, and please stay safe out there.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.